Welcome to this week's America podcast. I'm Luke Hansen. In the November 18th issue of America, the editors wrote about the expansion of U.S. intelligence agencies since September 11th, 2001, and the need to end the CIA's involvement in military operations. Today, I am joined by Ray McGovern, who worked as a CIA analyst for 27 years as a specialist in Soviet politics. He served on the daily briefing teams for Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. Thanks for joining me, Ray.
Most welcome.
You're a graduate of Fordham Prep and Fordham University, where we're doing this interview. Can you talk a little bit about the faith and moral foundation that your time with Jesuit education gave for your career as a CIA analyst?
Well, I can, yeah. I think there was a moral foundation, but also a foundation in how you think about things or how you analyze things. In those days, I was a classics major, so I was subjected to 4 years of Latin and 3 years of Greek. And my father kept telling me that, you know, that's going to be very helpful for you being a logical person and being able to figure things out. And, you know, it really did help. I went to college there at Fordham and majored in Russian. And we had a very strong Russian department there, so I stayed for my MA degree in Russian language and literature. And, of course, this was the early 60s, so it set me up very, very well for the Soviet Union sending up Sputnik and threatening Berlin and Cuba. And it was a natural, after my army service, to go into the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst.
What was it like to be on those briefing teams for three different presidents? What did that work involve, and what were some of the things you learned during that time?
Well, it was a heady experience, as you can imagine. When we were preparing the president's daily brief for President Nixon and then later President Ford, it was less exciting because they had a special assistant to the president for national security affairs named Henry Kissinger, who knew everything about everything. And so what we would do is simply send down the president's daily brief in the morning, six mornings a week, but Kissinger would choose whether or not to give it to the president, and he'd put in marginalia saying this is ridiculous or this kind of stuff. So we didn't have direct access to the president then. With Reagan, we did. And it's an interesting story, actually. When he became president-elect, some senior staffers, more senior than I in those days, decided, look, you know, he should be getting the president's daily brief right away because he knows so little about foreign affairs. So they went to the director, Director Turner, and he said, sure, that sounds good, but let me check with Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter said, of course. And so the next morning, these two enterprising colleagues got the classified version of the president's daily brief at a remote facility in California, showed up at Pacific Palisades, told the Secret Service, CIA briefers, Secret Service says, we don't have any word about CIA briefers. Well, there must be a glitch back in Washington. We're here to see President-elect Reagan. Just then, as luck would have it, Reagan came down in his pajamas. What's going on out here? President's daily briefers, sir. Oh, come on in. So there began the story. Every day, 6 days a week, either one or the other of these senior briefers, one-on-one with the president-elect. He really liked the treatment. And when he got to Washington to become president, George H.W. Bush, his vice president, said, okay, now, Mr. President, how are we going to set up these daily briefings? And the president said, well, I'd like you to get it, of course, one-on-one treatment. And, of course, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, I'd like my national security advisor to get it. And Bush said, well, now what time would you like to? And Reagan said, well, you know, I think maybe it'd probably be better if you got the one-on-one treatment, the ones I just mentioned. And why don't you come see me at 11:30 and tell me what I should be thinking about? So we had one-on-one access to the most important national security officials. We later added the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but we didn't have normally, on occasion we did, but not normally, direct access to the president. But that was better in a way because they all knew that the others were getting the same treatment, and they were prepared to discuss from these articles. there are only about five or six a day, what the president really needs to be interested in. So that was a very heady experience. My route usually was Secretary Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, and the chairman, the National Security Assistant. But then later, I saw President George H.W. Bush, Vice President, actually, every other morning, together with Secretary Shultz, Secretary of State, and most pleasurable, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, Jack Vesey, a brown shoe soldier from World War II, Battlefield Commission. He knew what was up, and he reeked with integrity, which was made him very exceptional in Washington during that period.
What good were you doing during those years? How did you feel like you were serving the country? And did you experience any conflicts of conscience or any doubts about the role that you were playing on the national security team at that point?
Not conflicts of conscience. Slight misgivings about bureaucracy. It was an interesting experience. We were trusted, very senior analysts, and we were set one-on-one with Secretary Shultz, Secretary Weinberger, the Vice President. And we were trusted to speak from our experience, not just to answer questions about the written articles in the President's Daily Brief, but to supplement them as needed. And so when Mikhail Gorbachev came into office, the big question, of course, was, is this guy the real deal? I mean, he's talking a good game, but, you know, he's a communist after all. He's a party general secretary. How can we trust what he says? Well, when I say bureaucratic difficulties, the CIA was run in those days by a Fordham alumnus named Bill Casey. He was a great warrior against the Nazis, but against the Soviets, not so great. He saw a Russian under every rock in Nicaragua. He was afraid that the Russians were going to come up through Mexico into Texas. I couldn't believe it. So the president was getting this stuff from Bill Casey. And he appointed a very malleable manager of analysis. The fellow's name is Robert Gates. He used to work for me, actually, in the early 70s. He was an incredibly ambitious fellow, and if Casey saw a Soviet under every rock in Nicaragua, Gates saw two. That's metaphor, of course, but not far off the truth. Long story short, Casey and Gates told the president and everybody else who would listen, this was a big farce. Don't trust Mikhail Gorbachev. He's a commie. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union will never give up power. Beware. Now, here I am in Secretary of State Shultz's anteroom, and I get a toss. In those days, the telegraphic service of the Soviet Party comes in, and his assistant gives it to me, and it says, Secretary Shultz is invited to visit the Soviet Union. So this was within my purview of updating these things, and so I gave the thing after the president's daily briefing. I gave it to Secretary Shultz. And he asked me, well, how do you guys feel about Gorbachev? And I said, well, the people that I admire and the people that I know, and I know something about the Soviet Union myself, say he's the real deal. He smiled. I knew, and he knew, that that's not what he's hearing from Bobby Gates or from Bill Casey. But guess what? He heard the same thing I was purveying from his Soviet specialists. He went to Moscow. Long story short, they took it seriously, and all of a sudden, you had a real Soviet Union with openness, with restructuring, and of course, then dissolving of not only the Soviet Communist Party, but the Soviet Union itself. So this was heady. It was a challenge, because I had a conscience, and I also had a lot of experience in Soviet foreign policy, Soviet internal policy. And I knew the analysts who were being suppressed by Casey and Gates, and I was in touch with them. I knew that their opinion was much more close to the mark than what he was hearing from Casey and Gates, and so I told them what I thought.
In November, the editors of America wrote an editorial that was critical of of the expanding intelligence apparatus in the United States since September 11th, and a number of the activities that the CIA has been involved in, like drone strikes and running secret prisons and rendition. What's your kind of response to what's changed since September 11th? How do you find yourself, relating to it? What's your response been?
Well, my response is on two levels, really. One is the moral level, and the other one is with the constitutional level. And I feel sort of pledged to heed my conscience on both scores. Moral level, torture. Now, when I was here at Fordham, we were taught that there was such a thing as intrinsic evil, right? And in that category was lumped slavery, rape, torture, and genocide. No question about it, always evil. Now, when I saw what evolved from what I brand as the first clear American war of aggression against Iraq, and I use that term advisedly, because the Nuremberg Tribunal said that the a war of aggression is, quote, the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole, period, end quote. Accumulated evil of the whole. How about kidnapping? How about torture? How about setting up black prisons out of anybody's control, even in Europe? Well, that struck me as intrinsically evil. And so there was no question in my mind that Nuremberg was right. Once you started a war of aggression, the accumulated evil includes things like this. Now, it also includes things that impinge upon my oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That gets us to, well, let's do drone killings first. The President of the United States claims to have the right to kill American citizens with drone strikes without due process. It's happened 4 times already. He has defended it. And, of course, John Brennan, Fordham College, 1977, is the mastermind of all this drone stuff, and he ran the drones for a long time, still runs them from his new perch as head of the CIA. Now, what's my problem with that? Well, just the Fifth Amendment, which says, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. My God, I live in Virginia now. I feel very close to the founders of our Constitution, the ones that wrote that Bill of Rights. How can the president pretend to have the authority to kill American citizens without due process of law? He cannot. That's just the drone strikes. Now, other people are human too, last time I checked the Bible, so I don't think the president really has the right to send John Brennan to send off drones into Pakistan, with which we are not at war, to strike even what they call associated targets or targets that are thought to be militants or insurgents or terrorists or whatever you want to call them. So that's the Fifth Amendment. Now, how about the Fourth? Well, the Fourth one says the right of the people to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, clearly defining the places to be searched and the people or things to be seized. That's a direct quote, okay? How in the world can you explain what NSA is doing and the president fully supporting that as consonant with the Fourth Amendment? You simply cannot. Probable cause? Does that mean that all these people, all of us whose phone records and emails are being collected, that we're probably terrorists? I don't think so. Clearly defining the places to be searched and the people and the things to be seen. I don't think that clearly defines. These dragnet approaches are clearly unconstitutional. And so on constitutional grounds, I object strongly. And there are millions of people that took the same constitutional oath that I did. And I hope that they wake up, because this is the beginning. This is the beginning of a word I'm not supposed to use, okay? Because they say, oh, the people will identify that with the Holocaust. Well, don't identify it with the Holocaust. Just recognize what it is. You have government. You have corporations who are profiting greatly from these wars. You have media. You have the national security apparatus. You have even the Congress, all cooperating in a nexus to violate our constitutional rights in the same way that happened in Germany in 1933. It's incipient fascism. Do not blanch before the word. And one German young lawyer who wrote a diary at the time said, you know, it was truly remarkable. We all watched the creeping fascism happen as if from a box at the theater. And my concern now is that that's what we're doing, most of us American citizens, and it's all so easy to do because of the corporate control of the media, the same corporations who are profiteering on the war. And that's why I cite what Martin Luther King Jr. said in that wonderful piece of American literature, the letter from the Birmingham City Jail. He talked about exposing these evils, these injustices, these lies. And he said, he compared it to a boil. He said, like a boil that can never be cured until it is opened up with all its pus-flowing ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. So too, injustice must be exposed with all the friction its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. And that's my mission. That's the mission of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. That's where we try to get a hearing. It's real hard in the major media, but we're making a dent. And as far as I can tell, I need to keep plugging away, using the whatever credibility I have from my 27 years working for the CIA and the moral authority that I bring from my Jesuit education and from what I've learned since Fordham, and try to bring it to bear in a package that is somewhat unusual, some people think unique.
So you've got a really strong moral analysis, constitutional analysis, political analysis of what's going on, and you've described, you know, this obligation that you feel to do something and to respond and to tell the truth. Where has that taken you in the past few years? And what are some of the things that you've tried to do? What are some of the things that other Americans can do to respond to the situation that we're living in right now?
The major problem, in my view, is the death of the Fourth Estate. Now, when Thomas Jefferson was asked if he had to choose between a free media, of course, this was the press at the time, a free press and a government, which would he choose? Of course, he said free press every time, because without a free press, you cannot have anything approaching a free government. There would be tyranny. That happens to be the case. And that's why Edmund Burke, the 18th century British statesman, stood up in Parliament, of which there were three houses at the time. They call them estates. And he said, you know, I'm proud to be a member of one of these three estates and House and Commons and Lords, but there's a fourth estate. And he pointed to the balcony. He said, you gentlemen in the balcony, you members of the press, the newspapers, you are far more important, the fourth estate, than we three, because you keep us honest. Well, fourth estate is dead. Good news is that there's a fifth estate. And that is in the internet. In the web, I don't know how it works, but it's in the ether somewhere. It comes down into my computer. I can find out what's going on, and so can everyone else. I ask my grandchildren, please try to find a way that we seniors can just press two keys instead of three or four to get the news. Well, you can. You can. You just have to be interested enough, because you're not going to get it from the evening news. Now, once you get the news, then you have to decide, you know, what you're going to do about it. You know, it's really nice to have principles and all, but if there's nothing for which you will suffer for those principles, then you don't have compassion. which comes from two Latin words, to suffer with. If you're not willing to stick your neck out. Now, you know, I don't have anything against necks. I mean, they're very convenient connections between head and torso. But if there's nothing for which you will risk that neck, then it becomes your idol. And necks are not worthy of idol worship. When I think back now at the founders, and George Mason lived about three blocks from where I live now in Northern Virginia, I think about what they risked. You know, when they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to this enterprise, my God, you know, it was more likely than not they'd end up on the end of a rope, okay? And they did it anyway. And now we have the Bill of Rights that Mason felt so strongly about that even though he drafted most of the Constitution, he went up to James Madison at the end. He said, Jim, sorry, I can't sign this Constitution. And Madison said, come on, George. You drafted most of it. And George says, no, I'm sorry. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights. I can't sign. So they did a deal, okay? James Madison said, look, if you keep quiet about this, I mean, it'd be the kiss of death if just keep quiet. I guarantee that we'll send horsemen up and down the eastern seaboard. We'll get those Bill of Rights ratified. In those days, gentlemen kept their promises. The Bill of Rights was ratified a few years later. Then George Mason was fully in, okay? Those are the kinds of people that we owe some allegiance to, we should be proud of. And we should remember what Benjamin Franklin said as he came out of the Constitutional Convention. A woman came up to him and said, now, what have you created for us? And he said, madam, we have created a republic if you can keep it. And my concern and my energies are directed at making sure we can keep it. And right now, it's a more precarious position than has been the case in my 74 years on this planet.
I've been talking with Ray McGovern, a student of history and someone who continues to serve this country. Thank you for talking with us this morning.
You're most welcome.